You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Mephibosheth, this interesting narrative in chapter 9 of 2 Samuel. We read in verse 1, after all of this conquest, David is the undisputed champion. He's the king of Israel. And at this point, he asks, is there anyone still left in the house of Saul? Now, if you know anything about the ancient Near East and how autocrats operated at this time, you know that this is a loaded question. When you took over a dynasty as a king, you were looking out at everyone else that could be a potential usurper to you. So is there anyone left from the house of Saul who was the man that was trying to kill David? Dale Davis, in his commentary, writes this. He says, when a new regime or dynasty came to power, the name of the game was purge. Yep, you don't need to be an expert in the ancient Near East. This is in the Old Testament. When you see a king take the throne repeatedly, whether it's Baasha, Zimri, Jehu, etc., etc., whenever there's another dynasty, another family, they want that family wiped out. Because you don't want the son or grandson to hit puberty, start lifting weights, wield a sword, come back and take off your head. So Davis writes, the new king always needed to solidify his position. It was a conventional political policy, solidification by liquidation. You just wiped out the opposition. Everybody knew it. Everybody believed it. Everybody practiced it. So, let me say this again. David asked, is there anyone left in the house of Saul? How would you expect, given that cultural landscape, for David to finish this question? He says, to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake. This is the Hebrew word hesed that is used 248 times in the Old Testament, most of which refer to God's hesed, his loving kindness, his love for humans. And David is saying, is there anyone in the house of Saul, that man, that bitter, insecure man who had me on the run for 15 years? Are there any of his descendants whom I can show hesed, kindness to? For Jonathan's sake, what does he mean by that? Well, you remember back in chapter 20 in the first book, verse 14, Jonathan and David were extremely committed friends. And Jonathan said to David, I know you're going to be the king. I know that. So please, show me unfailing hesed, kindness, like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. Do not ever cut off your hesed, kindness, from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. When you're on the throne and there's no more enemies and you're completely safe and secure, please, David, make this promise, this covenant, this contract with me, that you're not going to wipe out my descendants. We read in verse 42 that David told Jonathan, we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord. The Lord is witness right now between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever. He made this pact with them. He sees them one more time. And then Jonathan dies. So let me repeat again. To whom can I show kindness, hesed, for Jonathan's sake? No, there was a servant of Saul's household, this evil tyrant that had tried to kill David for over a decade, named Ziba. They summoned Ziba to appear before David, and the king said, are you Ziba? At your service, he replied. The king asked, is there no one still alive from the house of Saul to whom I can show God's hesed, God's kindness? Not just kindness, not just using the word, but actually saying, I want to show God's love and kindness. Isn't there someone left to whom I can show God's kindness? Ziba answered the king. He said, Mephibosheth is a son of Jonathan. Whoa. David didn't know Jonathan had a son. He thought that he was probably wiped out when the Philistines came. They killed Jonathan. They killed Jonathan's brothers. They killed Saul. Probably thought that this kid was dead. Both of his feet are disabled, and he cannot walk. So Jonathan was a person with a physical disability, the inability to walk. We read about this. We skipped over this earlier. But in chapter 4, verse 4, we get the backstory here. Jonathan had a son named Mephibosheth who suffered a terrible accident. He was 5 years old when the report came from Jezreel that Saul and Jonathan, his dad, had been killed. Grandpa and dad are dead. The Philistines came through and they wiped out all of the leadership. They put Saul's head on a spike. They killed his uncles. So at this point, they were in a complete panic. And when the child's nurse heard the news, the nurse of Mephibosheth, she picked up Mephibosheth and she fled. But as she hurried away, she dropped him and he became disabled. So this little boy, 5 years old, on the same day that he learns grandpa's dead, dad's dead, uncles are dead, he goes through a complete breakdown of his body. He is disabled for life. What was the nature of this disability? I don't know. But he can no longer walk. Was it a spinal injury? Was it a fracture that couldn't be mended? I don't know. All I know is this is the worst day of his life. David asked, "Where is he?" Ziba answered, "He is at the house of Machir, son of Amiel, in Lo Debar." See, they're down here in Jerusalem. This is the capital of Israel. Lo Debar is this little podunk village. We don't even know where it was today. They think it was 10 miles south, southeast of the Sea of Galilee. And there's a reason that we're not certain where this place is. It's because Lo Debar literally means no place. So when modern archaeologists and scholars are trying to figure out the place, they're trying to find no place. It's like a who's on first joke, right? So he's up here in Lo Debar. What's he doing up there? Well, we read in verse 5, King David had him brought down from Lo Debar in the middle of nowhere from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor, literally threw himself forward and fell down. His face was touching the ground. His nose was on the floor, wasn't even looking up at David. And you have to ask yourself at this moment, what was it that Mephibosheth was feeling when David said to him, "Mephibosheth"? He can't even look at him. He's just saying, "At your service." He can't even look at David in the eye. What was he feeling? You think about his history. He was 5 years old, a little five-year-old boy, when he was orphaned. And on that day, he heard about this guy, David. Now, he's five. I don't know how many memories you have from when you were 5 years old, but he doesn't know that this was David, his dad's best friend. You know, Uncle David and, you know, Jonathan, his dad, and David were best friends. Even if he did know that David and Jonathan were friends, he didn't know about this covenant, this promise that David was going to protect all of Jonathan's descendants. So Mephibosheth is under the impression that David, the reigning king, is doing what every reigning king would do in that position, hunting and killing, purging anyone from the other dynasty, the dynasty of Saul. So this whole picture, he's carried with him about the king into adulthood. He's got this picture. He knows this too, the story of Ish-bosheth. This was Mephibosheth's uncle. And these two rogue soldiers, these wicked men, as they're called, go in and Ish-bosheth is taking a nap and they come in and stab him, bring the body to David. David's like, "Why would you kill?" So he kills the wicked men. But all Mephibosheth would have known is that, okay, they killed my uncle, they killed my dad, they killed my grandpa. And here we've got this guy, David. He's on the throne. I know my dad was supposed to be on the throne. And then I was going to be on the throne after my dad. And my grandpa was on the throne before him. And all I know about this David guy is that he took over when I was five. And my family's dead. And now I'm disabled. And he's been living in hiding ever since, just in abject fear. Fear of the king. the sovereign king. He's got this whole picture of this sovereign that's there, that's on the hunt, wanting to kill him. And what are the very next words out of David's mouth? Mephibosheth, at your service. Can't even look up at him. The very next thing we read is David said to him, "Don't be afraid. I can see it. It's written all over your face. Okay? You're white as a ghost. You're trembling. None of that. Don't be afraid of me. I will surely show you chesed, loving kindness, for the sake of your father, Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather, Saul, and you are always going to have a place at my table." So, with just a few sentences, this entire construct of what David the king was is shattered. And here we have a totally different picture of the king in Mephibosheth's eyes. Well, he bowed down and he said to David, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?" Well, you say, why would he pick those particular words? This was a common idiom or a common language used at the time. If you recall in chapter 17 of the first book, when Goliath goes out to see David in combat, he sees this little boy with the sling and he says, "What am I, a dog that they brought you out to slay me?" And we see that David says to Saul, "What am I, a dead dog that you're chasing me in the hills?" And we're going to see throughout the rest of the book that they, when they were trying to refer to themselves in the worst possible way, they would say a dead dog. And this is Mephibosheth's self-identity, referring to himself as a dead dog. As commentator Joyce Baldwin puts it, this is a morbid self-image, induced perhaps by his disability. This was a time and place in history where people were just absolutely cruel to those who were disabled, whether mentally, emotionally, physically, doesn't matter. They looked at these people as though they were under the very curse of God. They were being cursed physically because they deserved it. They thought, I mean, this runs all the way into the years of Jesus, where even Jesus' own disciples, wouldn't these be the men that you would say they should know better? And they came to Jesus and they saw a man who was blind, or they saw people that were murdered, or they saw people under which a tower fell. And they looked at them and they said, "Were they more sinful than the rest of us?" And Jesus says, "No, they weren't more sinful." But in the construct of this religious thinking, this cruel construct, these people believed that if you were disabled, there was something that you did that was wrong, and so you deserved it. Blame the victim. Mephibosheth's name even means, quote, "from the mouth of shame." This guy would have taken it from all of the bullies, from all of the people, from all of the religious leaders, going to the temple, or rather the tabernacle, going to anyone would have looked at him and just said, "This man is just, that he's under the curse of God." He would have been bullied to the point where they name him from the mouth of shame. And he's looking at David, even after hearing, "You're always going to have a place at my table. I'm going to take care of you forever. For the sake of your father, I'm going to do it." And he's looking at that, and he's still holding on to what? Something that he's probably heard for his entire life. "You're just a dead dog." And that's how he thinks about himself, as a dead dog. So he acts like a dead dog. Even when the king is speaking to him and saying, "You're not a dead dog. You're not worthless. You're not a nobody." He can't get this out of his head. The king summoned Ziba, the king's servant or steward. And he said to Ziba, "I have given your master's grandson," that's Saul, "everything that belonged to him and his family. You and your sons and your servants are going to go farm the land for Mephibosheth, and you're going to bring in the crops for him so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of Saul, will always eat at my table." It's almost like he needs to drive this nail home. He tacked it in and now he's just coming in, boom, boom, boom. He's always going to have a seat. It's going to be right there at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. What a worthless man, Ziba. This guy was getting rich off of this disabled man. The property, yeah, it technically belonged to Mephibosheth, but he couldn't farm it. He couldn't do anything with it. He had a disability. So Ziba's like, well, I'm the servant, so I'm going to go in and do the farming. And David's just like, we're done with that. We're done. Okay, you're going to farm it. You're going to do your job, and then you're going to give the money back to the person to whom it belongs, the owner, Mephibosheth. This guy has 15 sons, 20 servants. He's rich. Then Ziba said to the king, okay, chill out. All right, your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do, my lord the king, your honor. So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son himself named Micah. And all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. And then it concludes, as if we didn't know this already. By the way, both of his feet were disabled. Like it's like an inclusio. You know what I mean by that? It's a literary device. It's at the beginning and it's at the end of the pericope, you know, the narrative. It's like at the beginning, this guy is disabled. And at the end, he's disabled. And in the middle, what do we see? Well, we see an extraordinary picture of God's kindness to this man. God's kindness. If you were to read this, as I often did, and come away with the notion that this narrative is just about a really, really nice guy by the name of David, who was just trying to help out this poor man who was disabled, you would be completely and utterly missing the point. Don't you remember Nabal? Remember the story of Nabal the fool? Do you remember that? David is not a nice guy, whatever that means. He's not a kind guy. Nabal insulted him, and David earlier in the book said, I'm going to go in there, and I'm not just going to kill Nabal. I'm going to kill everybody. Okay? This is not a guy that's just, you know, plays well with others. This is not the story of a nice guy. This is rather the story of a man who was after God's very own heart. He had received such incredible loving kindness from God that three times we read, to whom can I show kindness? To whom can I show God's kindness? I will surely show you kindness for the sake of Jonathan. He wants to give what he had received. That is the picture here. How is it that you change people? You change people not through fear, not through threats. Yeah, that can change behavior to a certain degree. We all know that. We all work at a job. You know, the boss says, you show up here late again, you're fired. You know, you get there 15 minutes early for the next 2 weeks, right? It can change your behavior. I've seen people, you know, quit certain addictions and they get into the gym and, you know, they pass school. It's all fear threat. It's the consequence. That can change superficial behavior. But how is it that you change a human nature that is fundamentally selfish in looking out for itself to one that is loving and kind toward others? How do you do that with fear threat? We're seeing here the picture of a man whose heart has been transformed by the God who is kind. This word that I keep repeating, this word hesed, kindness, very difficult to translate, and I'm no Hebrew scholar, so I won't pretend to have any kind of authority in this sense, but I will take my stance on this, that kindness is a terrible translation. That sounds so syrupy and so tasty of kindness, kindness, kindness. This is not what that word means, okay? This word has the connotation of a loyal love. This is very often in the context of a covenant or a contractual agreement where it's not just that I'm kind to you or that I love you in some kind of an emotional sense. It isn't less than that, but it is more. So a loyal love is what Bruce Waltke, the Old Testament scholar, would say captures hesed, or Others have said a steadfast love or loving kindness. That's the King James. They actually got it pretty close for once. Loving kindness is actually pretty good. A loyal love, a steadfast love, a love that pursues, a love, well, as R. Laird Harris says, it is a kind of love that includes mercy. When the object of love is in a pitiful state. In case you don't see where this is going, maybe you're tracking with me and you can see where this is headed. This is the New Testament equivalent of the concept called charis, grace. Charis is the root word from which we get our word charity. Charis, charity. Hesed is the loyal love, the steadfast love, the committed love, the tender love. For whom? Those who are very often in a pitiful, awful, abject state. That is what we're talking about here when we say love. So no, I don't like the translation kindness. Okay, I've seen a lot of kind people. This is taking this concept to an entirely new level. So to dig even deeper, what we're seeing here is that this whole narrative is a lesson in God's grace. What do we learn about God's grace from this narrative? To begin, God's grace pursues us. Mephibosheth wasn't looking for the king. The king was looking for Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was actually hiding from the king as best as he could. And David was the one who was looking around, searching out. Your name is Ziba. You used to work for Saul. Do you know anyone? Where does he live? Send the men up there, 50 miles. Bring him back here. It was, as C.S. Lewis used to put it about God, he said that when he came to faith in Christ, the great Oxford professor, C.S. Lewis, he said, it felt like the hound of heaven, that he was being pursued by God to the extent that he could just feel God sweating him down, that I want to know you. Why are you rejecting me? Stop pushing me away. And we see very clearly that is the grace of God. So I'm comfortable when people say, I was pursuing God, or I was seeking God, or I was a spiritual seeker, as long as that is all under the auspices of the fact that God was seeking you first. The only reason that you had the inclination or proclivity to turn toward God was because God was pursuing your heart and moving in your heart. Okay, I got this story. 2004, I'm working on my undergraduate degree. It took me 7 years, and no, I did not become a doctor, all right? And I'm, you know, halfway through, and I'm sitting at Oxley Library. Do they still have that library on campus? They do. This was the old one. This was the ugly one that smelled like dirty feet, okay? So I'm sitting outside, and I've got my Hemingway, and I've got my Thoreau for my English class, and I got my Marlboro cigarettes and my lighter, and it's a nice, you know, fall day. And this guy comes up to me, and he says, hey, buddy, can I have a light? I look up. I say, sure. Because smokers are friendly people. So I give him my lighter. I recognized him from class. We struck up a conversation. Turns out he's a Christian. Turns out I'm interested in Christianity for once in my life. I mean, it was like a moment of like a window of like a month or two where I finally was like, I think I want to be interested in Christianity. And now I met one. And he's there. And he's like, well, do you want to talk? So we're talking for 2-3 hours, then we go to class, then we get dinner, we become friends. I go out to one of his small group Bible studies, and within a couple weeks, I came to Christ. And you know what bothers me about that whole story? What if I didn't smoke? You see the causal chain of events? Like, what if my Marlboros weren't out on the table, and then he wouldn't have come over to me, and then I wouldn't have talked to him, and then my life was going in a certain direction. It was going really bad, really bad. And then, you know what that is? That is a bunch of nonsense. That the God of the universe, the sovereign king who is in charge of everything, that it all came down to a coincidence? No, that whole picture, my little story there, that whole picture is that God was pursuing me and he was going to find any way to get my attention. I've quit smoking since then, in case you're wondering. Nobody was. All right, let's keep going. What else do we learn about God's grace? It is not based on performance or merit. Could we find a more pitiful character than that of Mephibosheth. You say, well, that's pretty cruel. I'm not saying that's the way I view it. I'm saying in this culture 3,000 years ago, this man was at the lowest strata of society. Everybody looked down on a man like this. Not the kind of man that you would get in your palace, not the kind of man that you would have eating at your table forever, not the kind of man that you would want as your friend. And yet David sees this man and he says, that is the man that I'm going to bring into my company, into my friendship. I'm going to bring him close. Why? Because he earned it? Because there was some merit within him? No. There was no comparison. There was no performance. There was nothing about, it's not Mephibosheth. It wasn't that there was something lovable in Mephibosheth. It's that the king was loving. We don't get this. Like, we love others because they're lovable. We love others because, oh, that look she gives me. Oh, her hair, it smells like cinnamon. It's just so great, you know? Okay. That's why we love. We love because there's something in the object that's worthy of love. We love because the person is lovable. That's not grace. Grace is that it's love not based on the object. Actually, grace is such that the object could be absolutely pitiful, and yet that is when grace operates the most. God's grace gives to us only because God is a giver. With Mephibosheth, it's not that he had something in himself with which he could barter or bargain or negotiate. When he was sitting there in front of David, he couldn't even look up at David. He was in fear. He was trembling. And David had to actually assure him, don't be afraid. It's cool. We're good. There was nothing. It's not that God's grace gives because there's something in the object. It's just that God is a giver. That's what this whole concept is. I had a friend come up to me recently. He said, you know, I've been really trying to make an impact for Christ. I mean, really trying hard. And, you know, I keep putting in effort and I keep trying and I feel like I'm growing, you know, and I like to read my Bible. I'm growing in that, and my prayer, that's getting deeper, and it, right on down the line. And you could just see it on the guy's face, you know, he's really trying. He's like, but I'm not seeing the results. He's like, what advice do you have for me? I was like, join the club? I don't know, you know? Like, my friends are telling me, you know, I think that you're growing in love. Like, they've told me that. And I'm like, wow, it's great to hear. I love to hear that. You know, I think I'm deeper than I was 5 years ago. I think I love God more than I did 5 years ago. But I'm currently working twice as hard as I ever did, and I'm seeing half the results. What's that about? Why? You know, why? Why is it that you're not doing anything? I'm working so hard here. And God's like, I don't bless your life because of your hard work. It isn't something meritorious in you that I would bless your life. Why is it that you love me more? Why is it that you love people more? Why is it that you'd want to listen to my words? Why is it that you'd want to talk to me in prayer? Why is that? Because you're trying to get something out of it? Is that it? I don't know what that is, but that's not grace. Grace is showing up before God, being blown away that even though I am in a position of being least deserving nothing, not the week where everything is going well and I'm loving people and I just feel like I'm on fire and everything's, you know, I'm hearing from God. Not that week. It's the week where my mind is polluted and selfish that all of a sudden God just decides to bless. Why? I have no idea. Other than the fact that he is a giver. That's how grace operates. It isn't in the object. It's in the subject. You know, you think about Mephibosheth, and we'll close with this. His anticipation was, I deserve nothing but death. We read later in chapter 19 that David has another run-in with Mephibosheth, and he said, you know, David, at that moment, I just figured you were going to wipe me out. That's all I deserved was death. His anticipation. And yet, what did he actually experience with grace? The king wanted to show him chesed, kindness, not death. Coming to the king, it's not that you're going to die, nothing like that. Actually, I want to show you incredible loyal love. Mephibosheth was thinking, I'm going to live in poverty and destitution for the rest of my life. In actuality, the king gave him back everything that was lost from his grandfather's estate and more. He kept just piling on more and more workers, people to help him. I mean, there was no government agencies for people with disabilities. And David's like, we are going to solve this. They're going to take care of you. The anticipation was, my dad died when I was 5 years old. You know, the anticipation was, I am deeply broken on many levels, not just physically, also emotionally. I think of myself as a dead dog. You know, getting that out of your head. I was talking to a 70-year-old man recently. He said, I can still hear my father's voice in my head. You dummy, you idiot. You're a moron. What are you doing? 70 years old. This is Mephibosheth. You know, I was dealt a bad hand. I'm broken on many levels. And all this is swirling in my head. And then what's the reality? The king says, I want to adopt you as my son. And he ended up being royalty, quote, like one of the king's very own sons. How much different could that be from a dead dog? His anticipation was, if the king ever finds me, I'm dead. He's going to kill me. He will kill me. The actuality, the king wanted to come into his life to change his life for good and forever. Well, as we wrap up here, I guess I would just say this. If there's one thing I could leave you with, it would be this. Don't pity Mephibosheth. Also, don't envy Mephibosheth. Oh, wouldn't that be great to have all that money and those servants and be at the king's table? Or wouldn't that be terrible to be suffering in destitution and daily pain? No. In reality, each one of us here is in a far, far worse off position than Mephibosheth ever was. The Bible declares that each one of us has fallen short of God's morally flawless standard. That all of us have been born into this world with a nature within us that is selfish, and God looks at that, and his declaration for that is judgment. And the judgment is eternal separation from him. It's called hell. To wake up after death and to wake up and to be in hell. That is a horror beyond all imagination. I can't even imagine what that would look like to be separated from God and just to realize I blew it forever. That is our situation. Way worse than psychological difficulty. Way worse than a physical disability. But here's the good news. That's the bad news. Each of us, because we are sitting here in this room, you are hearing about an offer from a far greater chesed, a far greater kindness, and a far, far greater king than David could have ever been. I'm speaking, of course, of God through the person of his son, Jesus Christ, coming into this world. Why? Why was Jesus hanging for several hours on a Friday on a cross? He hung there, and in a profound moment in history, he did the unthinkable. He stayed. He stayed there for you so that you would never have to know what it's like to experience hell. So you would never have to know what it's to be like to be a dead dog, to be kicked out of the family, to be separated from God. He stayed there for you. All you have to do is just receive the love of God. Stop with the pride. Stop with the, you know, stiff-arming God. I'll get around to it later. I'll think about that later. No. Today is the day of salvation. Right now, we're talking about something that is profoundly easy. It involves lowering your pride and saying to God, I want what Jesus did to come into my life. I know he died, but I want that payment to pay for me. The Bible says at that point that you change fundamentally in your very nature from being under judgment to being under God's grace. You're no longer estranged. You're no longer separated. You are a son of the King, and you're welcomed by him for all of eternity. If you're here and you can't remember a time that you made that decision where you prayed to God and said, I want Jesus' death to apply to me, do that here with us tonight. You are never going to regret that decision. Having the love of God in your heart, just let that in, man. You will experience God on a whole new level.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.